What are you wearing?
It's nothing. Well, nothing. Not like, you know what I mean. You know what I mean.
Hi and hello, watch fans, and welcome to another edition of The Real Time Show with me, your friendly neighborhood watchmaker, Rob Nuts. I'm joined today by our friendly neighborhood jeweler, Alan Ben-Joseph, and our resident provocateur, David Vaucher, as we discuss the upcoming Watches and Wonders event in Geneva and the surrounding Geneva Watch Week, and go through exactly what kind of challenges we expect the brands to be facing with this year's release slate and exactly what we'd like to see from our favorite brands amongst them. Gentlemen, welcome to the studio.
Thank you. I'm super excited to be here and excited for our upcoming trip. It's the highlight of the horological year for me.
Sun is shining and I get to talk to you both, not only about watches, but watches and wonders. So this is a highlight of my day for sure.
All right, David, let's start with you and your assessment of this, because you are obviously very well versed in writing about industry conditions. So what is it you expect brands to be facing as they hope to have success with this year's release schedule?
Oh, this is an excellent question. As I'm listening to the wind up to this and seeing all the new releases come out, I've been on record and we've been on record as saying there most likely will be, and this is a hypothesis, but if you ask me personally, most likely there will be a downturn at the end of the year and going into next year. But we have to remember these watch releases have been worked on for years. And so I think that there will be a lot of enthusiasm this year, and quite rightly so. This is a fun business to be in. But I think a lot of that exuberance that we may be coming out of is still lingering. So we'll see a lot of that. One thing I want to pay attention to is going to be pricing. One thing that really caught my eye, and I know they're not exhibiting, but Blancpain's new 50 Fathoms, which is something else we've talked about at length on the show, came out. It looks great. The pricing is eye-watering. And so I'm going to be curious to see, for these new models that really get people excited, does the pricing line up with the market realities going forward or the market conditions that we've seen the last couple of years since the pandemic started?
Very interesting point, actually, about the length of time for which these models that we're seeing released now have actually been in development for. Now, that is something that we don't often talk about when we talk about how brands are dealing with shifting market conditions, which are evolving constantly. Do you think, let's take just a random brand, for example, let's take IWC, because I've been writing about some of their new stuff recently and they're in my mind. Let's say IWC have a 5-year development plan for their big pilot. And they know exactly what they're going to release this year in 25, 26, 27, 28, and 29. And then they find around 2026 that the desire for pilot watches drops off a cliff. And yet they're already on the way to bringing these models to life and had planned to put them out at a certain price point that nowadays would have been an easy sell. But in 2 years in the future, let's say, would be an absolute no chance in hell that they're going to shift them. So what do they do? Do they can a product? Do they put it on the shelf and wait for more opportune market conditions? Do they revise their communication strategy and drop the pricing? Or do they just push ahead blindly and then shrug when it doesn't work out, even though the environment into which they're releasing it was not the one for which it was designed? What do you reckon they do?
So the Swiss were as agile as dinosaurs during the Ice Age. They are becoming a bit better. I do think they still live in the ivory tower. They're not fast on their feet. They need to become faster. In their defense, though, it takes a long time for R&D to develop new movements, materials for cases, etc. That's in their defense. It's not a fast industry. That's what we love about it. It's not fast-moving consumer goods. It's meant to last. It's not throwaway culture. But they are often rigid in their mindset. So I think they should, in these cases that you project, Rob, shelf more things, freeze them, ice them out, or simply just cancel, just take your loss and move on, or pivot, or change. Some are doing that more and more now. An example is that the industry collectively killed Basel World, but without a strategy. Geneva Watch Days was born out of agility. Right? They came together, a few brands, and did a pop-up thing, and it's here to stay. We saw Watches and Wonders expanding now. It seems like Basel World is almost back. I just got an email that jewelry brands are exhibiting during the Watch and Wonders week in Geneva at a hotel. Those are my two cents on this topic.
Firstly, that is a damning indictment of the Swiss watch industry, because the dinosaurs have been dead for like 65 million years before the Ice Age rolled around. So they really aren't moving. They really are not kicking. That is brutal. Secondly, and probably more relevantly to the conversation, starting an event is one thing, but developing a product in place of a product that had been in development for several years prior, that's another, especially if we want that product to be innovative or interesting or actually tailored to the market conditions that are evolving more rapidly than products tend to behind the scenes. So what would you say brands need to be doing now? Do they need to have multiple product strategies in place and be able to shift between them more agilely?
Yes. David, take it.
I mean, there's a lot to say in this case. So, you know, clearly IWC was picked just at random. We're not picking on them in particular, but, you know, again, this is something we've talked about. I think you have to go back to the Beaver rule, which I think we can call it, the Beaver rule, sorry, which is, you know, value double the price. You have to talk about the king and queen, where the king is the customer, the queen is the product. You have to put them together, all of that. But I think if you look at conditions going forward, and if you have a product line you're considering for the next couple of years, my kind of maxim to myself is always start with the end in mind. So what are you trying to do here? And depending on what that answer is, you work backwards and you end up with a whole range of things. I mean, yeah, you can cancel a product, but that's harder or easier depending on how far along you are in the cycle. It's hard to change prices if you already announced them. So I wouldn't say that's necessarily possible. But I just, you know, and the difficulty too, I'm sorry, is also that when you have a group brand like IWC, there's additional pressure to sell. And it gets even more complicated when you're asking, who are you selling to? Because if you're selling to boutiques that you own, fine. But if you have an AD network where you can just push inventory, yeah, you can push inventory out. It looks like you're selling, but it's sitting in dealer cases and you're ultimately damaging your brand. So there is this whole calculus you have to run with brand perception, you know, maybe secondary market price, brand strategy, all of that has to be considered. And I think what that means is that brands are going to have some decisions to make, but I don't think we're going to see the impact of those decisions at this Watches and Wonders. I think that'll play out next year and, of course, the years after that.
Yeah, I think you're probably right about the time frame there of when we're going to see these decisions actually manifest or these changes in their strategy come to fruition. It is very, very interesting. I think like pricing is something they could play with before they announced it. You know, they could look at the conditions now and say, oh, maybe we were going to charge 15K for this piece. Now we're going to charge 12. And I think you mentioned in the previous episode that brands can also add value to existing models to try and rebalance that Beaver equation so that they don't have to pivot and change too quickly and look weak or aimless in the process. I'm a little worried that what we might see over the next couple of years is while brands are floundering for a foothold that previously seemed secure, is that they might throw a lot of stuff out there, like a huge number of references across all model collections to see what sticks, give themselves a chance to read the market in real time, as it were. Now, I don't like this from a branding perspective, from a communication strategy. I think every subsequent release that you add onto a release schedule dilutes the power of the core releases that you really want to use as a marker point of where you want the brand to go. But I could see it happening. I think we've seen it happen with some big brands recently. Omega is probably my normal go-to for this. Too many references, too little cohesion, and it doesn't feel like they are leading the discussion. It feels like they are subject to it.
Yeah, and here's another interesting point too, is that, you know, for a very conservative industry with CEOs that last a long time, I mean, think of, I think it's Mr. Walter O'Connell, maybe Alan, correct me if I'm wrong, but from Longines, he was CEO for just decades. And we've had quite a bit of turnover, right? I mean, you think about Davide Cerato taking over at Bremont. I guess where I'm getting at with this is that I go back to Breitling. So when George Kern took over, there was a window where watches came out that he clearly didn't have a hand in. And so what I think could happen is that if we go through a period of turbulence and there's a lot of turnover, you have to add on the other layer of uncertainty, which is as new leadership takes place, as new product strategies come about, you end up with watches that get released and they look very half-baked, and it just sort of makes it worse because you don't have this tight, cohesive package you're offering to people.
I love where we're going, and I see an article in it. I want to pause this discussion, if I may. I want to discuss novelties because we have a lot of ground to cover, and I suggest we are going to do a round what we see as a general trend or predict a general trend. What are we going to see as a trend at all these fairs? Because it's Watches and Wonders at the PAL Expo. We have Times to Watch at Head Geneva. And we have a lot of brands spread out in hotels and boutiques. So Rob and I had, well, I had 4 days, over 80 appointments planned. Rob too, but Rob is staying another day. Unfortunately, due to personal reasons, my dad needs a medical attention, so I had to cut my trip short, unfortunately. But I twisted Rob's arm to come on Monday with me, so we're going one day before the actual program starts everywhere. So Rob, you're going 5 full days, 6 days, am I correct?
I think I've got 5 full days, and then I get out of Dodge on Saturday, all being well, but we'll see. Watch this space. I might end up just moving to Geneva permanently to cover everything.
Yeah, I think we should just camp out there. Just take a Dutch canal boathouse and put it on Lake Geneva and just make a TRTS clubhouse. So all kidding aside, so I scaled down from about 80 meetings to 60. Rob is probably now knocking 100. We will obviously record at least 2 episodes with all our impressions after these fairs. Rob, I want to give you the honor to go first to share your wishes, dreams, predictions, and hunches about what we'll see in this week in Geneva.
Okay, so I think the way we're going to do this is attack it brand by brand, but obviously we're not going to go through every single brand that is showing in Geneva this time. We want to do one prediction episode. We have another interview coming up next week, which we'd like to get out before the fair because it's going to be very relevant and contain some very current information. So we're going to start with brands at PAL Expo, and we're going to go through them. Each of us is going to choose a brand in sequence. We're going to talk about what we'd like to see from that brand and maybe what we think we will see if we have any insight to that. Although obviously the pieces we've seen already that are embargoed, we can't discuss openly. We might skip those so we're not conflicted. And then we're going to go through the other locations and pick and choose the brands that we're most excited to visit. Although there are so many, like you say, Alan, we have got, yeah, almost 100 appointments throughout the week. So we have to be quite selective to get it done in a reasonable amount of time. Kicking off with PAL Expo, I'm going to start with happily the first alphabetically, but also one of the biggest brands shown, and that's A. Lange & Söhne. As you know, one of my favorite brands from my neck of the woods. And what do I want to see from Lange & Söhne? Now, what I'd love to see, which I am almost 100% positive we won't see, is pretty much anything in a steel case. Because as a fan of German watchmaking, I love those movements. I don't wear much precious metal at all. I think I might try and change that next year when I turn 40 and treat myself to a yellow gold watch. But it probably won't be a Lange to begin with because I just don't have the funds. Now, will we see any stainless steel cases from Lange? I don't think so. But besides that, what I would like to see is maybe another model or two in the very, very high-end stuff, just to continue to put out a marker point of something the rest of the industry can aspire to match. And I'd like to see another iteration of the Retropant from Lange & Söhne, perhaps in a honey gold with a new dial color and perhaps another little complication scrolled away there on the dial. Do you guys have any wishes from Lange & Söhne?
Yes, I do. And I'm going to bridge A. Lange & Söhne to the third brand with an A. Or actually, no, there are 4 brands with an A at the PAL Expo. I'm going to link it to Angelus because just now I received a press release that's not under embargo, because you're so right, Rob. We need to watch out that we don't share stuff that's under embargo till the 9th of April. Angelus, and we had a preview of that watch that they sent today, which I fell in love with head over heels during Geneva Watch Days. And that is their monopoussoir. They call it the Instrument de Vitesse, a 60 seconds flat central hand chronograph with a single pusher into the crown. So Monoposa is often used for a crown and a chronograph pusher, but this one is with the pusher inside the crown, so you only have one thing sticking out. I'm very much in love, and that's what I hope that Lange will make one day as well, a monopusher chronograph, because as far as my memory goes, they have never made one. Am I right?
Not one that springs to mind, that's for sure, but that is a lovely idea, actually. What a nice addition to the collection that would be. David, what are your thoughts on Lange, Angelus, and whatever brand you want to tackle first?
So what are my thoughts on the watches I may never own because they're out of my price range? You know, I think Angelus is one of those that it's very much a watch nerd's brand, and it's a revival of a brand which was around a long time ago. And to me, like, if you're going to revive an old name, this is how you do it. Because if you look at the vintage watches, they look like vintage watches, but the new stuff, the Chronodate in particular is the one I've always had my eye on. It's just awesome. It melds like that old design language with some new ideas. So I think, to me, more of that, basically. And I know that the Austrian Vitesse is very much back to the vintage roots. But if we could have a little bit more of that very forward design language, that'd be fantastic. As far as Lange, you know, that's a brand that obviously I know the releases that come out from them, but I wouldn't say they've been too on my radar. Having said that, the watch that I think if I was buying a Lange and I had just the, you know, unfathomably deep pockets, the one that made a mark on me, maybe you two remember it, was the little Lange Moonface from a couple of years back, the 36 millimeter watch. I just think that it was so perfect because it's smaller. I think it might have been marketed as a women's watch. But all of that kind of design language from Lange just compressed very efficiently onto a 36 millimeter dial, which was a venturine. It just worked. So I would love to see smaller, we'll call them concentrated versions of some of the classics. Like, this is a wish list, obviously, but a smaller Zeitwerk, I think it would look pretty great.
Oh, now that would be lovely, wouldn't it? I don't know how in God's name they would reduce the size of a Zeitwerk in particular, but in theory, I'm totally with you there, 100%. So which brand would you like to talk about first?
If you're giving me the freedom to skip around, I'm going to stay on brand. And I want to start with, I'm going to use fashion watch. We have to think of a better term than fashion watches, but I am extremely interested to see what comes out of Hermes and Montblanc. Cartier as well, but I think that's more of an expected and respected choice. But I think Hermes and Montblanc are two brands that don't get a lot of hype. No one really talks about them leading up to these shows. But when they deliver heat. And let's just start with Hermes. So Hermes recently, or a couple years back, had the HD08, which I think was a home run for them. But if you go back before that, they just have these really Hermes watches in the sense that everything is thought out. And they take everything very seriously. Like, I don't know if you both remember the, I think it was called the Heure Suspendue. So basically, time would freeze, and you could push a button, and it would show you the actual time and go back to being frozen. So there was just some high, high complication stuff coming out of that house. And I think we're going to see more of that. As far as Montblanc, I just think from the lower end to the higher end with their Minerva manufacturer, granted, the design language may not be for everyone. I think some of the watches they release tend to be a little bit too Indiana Jones for me. But you just cannot deny the quality that comes from those brands. So I would say that even though they're not as talked about, if you are looking for a watch that delivers absolute pedigree for a lot less money than you're going to see from some of these other brands, I think that those are absolutely two to watch out for. And I am super stoked to see what they bring to Watches and Wonders.
All right, nice. I'm glad you've taken it back to your wheelhouse with the, yeah, quote unquote, fashion watches that we all really love on the Real Time show. I'm a big fan of Hermes. I love the H08 model. I won't be as boring as I normally am and say, oh, I'd like to see more colors in that, although I would. But what I'd like to see is that model, which I believe only comes in 42 millimeters, arriving in a smaller case size. 40 millimeters would be fine. Doesn't have to go down any further than that. I think that it benefits from a bit of presence. So that would be nice. You mentioned Cartier in passing. I recently tried on the Cartier Santos de Cartier in midsize in full yellow gold. It was heavenly, an absolute dream, sat on my wrist perfectly. Although the sales assistant was trying to push me towards a larger size, I was like, no, this is the one. But it's 31,000 euros. It's a little bit rich for me at the moment, but something that I could look at maybe in the future in a few years' time. That'd be nice. Unfortunately, it only comes with a white dial. And I think that the yellow gold version, strangely enough, has black hands, which for me would make more sense to have blue. I think blue hands are a very Cartier thing. I believe that Louis Cartier might have been the first watch brand to use blue hands, although I'll probably have to eat my words on that. But I would love to see that midsize with blue hands, but more than that, I'd love to see it with a black dial, gold markings, and gold hands. That would be amazing. That would really pique my interest. But I'm going to go back to a brand that you skipped past that I would love to talk about a little bit, and that's Chopard. I am falling in love with the Alpine Eagle more and more with every passing day. And recently, I don't know how I missed them when they came out, but I've encountered a couple of dial colors in the Alpine Eagle that I'd missed when they were released, an ocean blue dial, and then there was a special edition for the Australian market, just 20 pieces with this burnt sunset or sunrise dial in a kind of red, similar to the Straum model we did for the Jan Mayen expedition, and they were both stunning. I absolutely love this watch. I think that it's still reasonably priced for a integrated steel sports watch from a luxury brand. I think the finishing is exceptional. I could do without some of the case-back crystal printing they sometimes do on these Chopards, but I have to say, if the Alpine Eagle gets some more colorways in a wider spectrum of sizes, because they already have, of course, the 36mm available, which is a little small and a little boxy for me, but why not see some more variations there to appeal to a wider audience? I think that model is really picking up pace. What do you guys reckon to that?
So I'll second you on Chopard. I will disagree with you on the Alpine Eagle. That watch has never done anything for me. The high frequency one is super interesting. I hope that movement makes it elsewhere. But I do have to second you on Chopard. That is another extremely underrated brand. I love the dress watch stuff they come out with. I would love to own a Chopard dress watch at some point. And it's always fun seeing their new releases. And just in passing, because maybe we'll get to them later, but if you're talking about Chopard, you have to talk about Ferdinand Berthoud because they're associated. They are always bringing just unbelievably killer stuff. So yeah, two thumbs up for me for Chopard.
It's not particularly commercial though, is it, that Ferdinand Berthoud stuff? It's one of my favorite high horology brands in terms of what they bring to the table technically. But it's really, I mean, it's obviously very expensive. And I love the way that they often hide tourbillons on the back of the case where I believe they belong. But I mean, really? There isn't an accessible model in that collection, and maybe not every brand needs one, but it's a bit of a shame because they do wonderful stuff, but very few people can touch it.
Yeah, and maybe, you know, Chopard, maybe they need to do a better job of advertising that they're associated, although I understand you have to keep the two separate, but I think we can just say Ferdinand Berthoud is the skunk works for Chopard. So they do the high-end stuff, and that radiates down to Chopard, but again, just another reason to check out that brand because highly underrated, but just phenomenal watchmaking coming out of them.
I can only second that. I love what they're doing. Love the last collab, again, between Chopard and Revo magazine, Gold Dial. I love that they do stick to that old-fashioned watchmaking. I do love the Alpine Eagle, so I'm with Rob on that. Going to the next brand, if I may. I do want to go chronologically because otherwise my mind is literally ping-ponging all over the place. I am happy to see a fifth A because I just said there are four A's, but there is a fifth one, Altia, which Rob and I visited in August during Geneva Watch Days in their boutique in Geneva. They are one of the new brands at Palexpo, and I'm very curious to see how they're going to succeed again, with something innovative, because as you know, I'm a big fan of the watermelon. Gents, take it from me.
Well, I'm a bit ticked off that Archer's at the Plexpo because I enjoy visiting their boutique in Geneva. And I also built my calendar around the assumption they were going to be in the same place as they always are. So I've got a bit of back and forth to do or maybe rescheduling that appointment. But fair play to them for stepping up and actually presenting at the Palexpo. I don't know how necessary that is for a brand like Archer because obviously it's a very niche proposition. And what we saw last year, while exciting, was again for the very moneyed few that have extremely offbeat taste. The Nano Sapphire cases, the Ivan Arpa, the founder and chief everything really at Archer is working with is unbelievable. It's a great technology. I'd love to see it deployed in different places. I'd love to see some nano sapphire dials as well as cases. I actually think that might be a more suitable application of the technology, but I'm very excited to see what he comes up with next. David, any thoughts on Archer?
Yeah, this is a little bit tangential, but I found out about them when Ariel Adams from A Blog to Watch was doing an overview of all of his watch collection during the pandemic. He spent a couple of days just covering watch upon watch upon watch. He talked about Artea. I love them. So first thing I would say is, if you're looking for some entertainment, go check those overviews out. I think they're just very relaxing and informative. And I'll just second the fact that they do very different things. Also high-end stuff, but I think that's what the high-end's for. You know, on one hand, you can say it's just for loading up a watch with diamonds and gold. On the other hand, you can say it's about trying new things, and Artea does that. So even though I don't think I'll ever own one, from a purely horological interest point of view, definitely one to watch as well. So I'm going to go to F, Frederic Constant, because that is a brand I can see myself owning. And they have been on fire recently from design point of view, value point of view. I mean, who else can you get like a Tourbillon? I think it's a Tourbillon perpetual calendar. And they go for, I think, 15,000-20,000 used, which is no small amount of money. But the value is just enormous. And they've had their moon phase recently. I mean, that is a brand that understands the Bivere rule. It's always been in their DNA. It seems like everything they come out with is just, it's just attractive and it's well done. And every time I see a new release from them, I think I definitely could see myself owning that. So that is another brand that's very, very excited to see what their new releases are. What do you both think?
Well, Alon is the man when it comes to Freddie C. I mean, he's very close to Niels. And Niels actually paid some of our listeners a little visit in Stockholm the other day, which was great to see. The Swedish mafia is gaining traction in the upper echelons of the watch world. Lovely to see. I agree. I wrote a review for WatchGecko not so long ago about one of the watches that Frederic Constant released with Peter Speke-Marin behind the design of the movement. And on paper, it sounds like a fever dream. It sounds like, oh, that can't be possible. How can you possibly get such a prestigious watchmaker to work on a piece that retails for such an accessible amount, considering what kind of technology is built into it? But there you go. They're doing wonderful things. They're really pushing the envelope. They are maybe more than most brands ascribing to the Bivere Maxim that we've discussed at length recently, and it's great to see. So who knows what they're coming up with next, because they really have surprised us in recent years, and I can't wait to see how they surprise us this time.
It's better that I shut up, because I know what's in the pipeline, so I don't want to trip up. So moving on, I'll hold on to the mic. Going back chronologically, I did not have Beauregard so much on my radar. We discussed it during the GPHG nominations. Rob infected me with his passion for the brand, but what really got me going was the interview Rob did with the founder. That really got me pumped. I've never held a Beauregard watch in my hands. So that's one of the visits and meetings we have planned that I'm really, really, really looking forward to. So that was my first B. Is there any other B brand you guys want to pick? And pun intended, because obviously they are not B brands, but A brands.
Yeah, I wasn't going to say this as my next choice because I'm itching to get back to the C that David mentioned. But there is one B brand I want to touch on. But before I do that, I better correct myself. It wasn't WatchGecko. It was for Revolution that I wrote that article about the Frederic Constant Slimline Perpetual Calendar manufactured designed by Peter Speke. So you should go check out that article on revolutionwatch.com because it is an incredible watch. Some beautiful little touches of design in there. And one thing which you'll learn about when you read the watch that I was particularly fond of. The B I want to talk about is Bremont. Because I am super interested to see what Cerato does with this. I believe that the general feeling is that he hopes to increase volume of sales by moving Bremont down in price bracket. I fully support this move in theory, and I can't wait to see what models he brings out to support it, because that could be a complete overhaul of the brand and its catalog. Alon, you're close to Girato. What do you think about that?
I am double subjective. I'm an authorized dealer. I'm the only Bremon dealer in the Netherlands already for, I believe, 12 or 13 years. I don't remember. I'm getting too old. I'm selling them too long. I'm close to Serato, but I kept the distance on purpose. I have no idea what's coming, and there's nothing lied about it. They didn't leak anything. I didn't ask for anything. I'm going blank on the first day as a retailer to visit Bremon, and I want to get wooed and overwhelmed. What you've said, Serato, indeed, has been communicating in interviews that he wants to push it a notch down on price points, same quality, do a bit more volume. But one rumor we heard in the TRTS network, so again, emphasis, rumor, I have not seen things on the embargo. I have no idea what Bremon is coming with, but that person in the TRTS network, and if you want to know who it is, join the network. He said they're working on a tourbillon, so that not so much contradicts what Serato's been saying in the media, but shows the elasticity of where he wants to take the brand.
You know, I think there's a couple of interesting storylines here. The first one is that, you know, I don't know, obviously, the fine details of Davide Serato's career, but I do know he was the designer behind the Tudor Black Bay, and we know how just hugely influential that was. So it's funny, like, I guess when you have huge success, I'd like to, if it ever happened to me, I had such a home run, I'd like to think I'd just pack it up and say I've done it. But I think that when you do that, the inclination is to say, can I do it again? And so he's got to have some of that going through his mind. Like, can I have another Black Bay? Can I prove that that first one wasn't just chance? Like, it really was me. So I think from a personal point of view, that's a really interesting story to watch. From a business point of view, yeah, I mean, the story is can Bremont make that pivot? And, you know, Mr. Serato has a lot of work to do, because within the watch circles, Bremont is viewed as a brand. Like, these are well-made watches from as far as I can tell. And what they've done with the wing is huge. Like, that is an enormous and commendable undertaking. But it always comes down to price. Always comes down to price. And so I'll be curious to see, regardless of what gets released, given some of the groupthink that tends to happen in watches, is the first comment going to be, yeah, but this is too expensive because I can buy X from someone else? So I think that is going to be very interesting to see how that develops. Rob, what do you think?
I think that Bremont needs this. It needs freshening up. It needs a change of direction. And it needs a new icon, if we want to use a word like that, within its collection. Since the MB model, the Martin Baker model that is best recognized for its knurled aluminium case cover and the triptych case design, the brand hasn't really had a standout piece. It tried to develop upwards with things like the Wright Flyer and the Hawking. They really missed the mark for me, I think. And then it tried with the Supernova, which was an ambitious attempt at doing something new that still adhered to their old case construction, although it went from a three-piece to a four-piece case construction. But it was never going to be the icon they needed. Now, Girato brings the opportunity to fuse his experience from his success with the Black Bay and the history of the MB and that novel case construction that Bremont has to maybe do something in that vein, but refreshed, powered by the ENG 300 or a derivative caliber thereof, and really, really put it on the map at an accessible price point. That ENG 300 movement, for me, was the most significant development Bremont has made in the last few years. It still hasn't found its home in a model that allows it to express itself in the best light, I don't think. And I think the price point was difficult. If you can get me an ENG 300 in an identifiably Bremont watch at under 5,000, I'm there. I'm back in. And I think that's the next step of the brand's development sorted for 5 years.
Yeah, it's interesting we're spending so much time talking about Bremont, but as you were talking, I had a couple other thoughts come to mind. This is a brand where I think there's some cleanup has to happen, because just from a movement perspective, let's leave aside, you know, some of the stories around Bremont within house. That's not the point. What I want to call out here is that there have been several announcements of new movements coming out. So I was kind of interested in one of their dress watches, the Mayfair Audley. which had one family of in-house movements. I think that was the last one. But then, and Alan, because you're a dealer, maybe you can correct me. They had the Longitude before that, which was another in-house movement. And so I don't know that I really care so much about the, is it fully in-house or not? I mean, the Swiss watch industry is structured how it is. So that's neither here nor there. But there is a lot of confusion on my part about, you know, what is new and then the various price points for that. So kind of to piggyback on your point, Rob, if you can get that movement from the Mayfair Audley, which I really like, and the Triptych case, which I really like, and a sports watch that has a very distinctive design language, and, you know, that's up to Mr. Sherrato and his team to work that out, and you price it accordingly, yeah, I think you've got a home run. But I think there's got to be some fundamental cleaning up and rationalizing in the catalog before that happens.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. Now, before we spend any more time talking about Bremont, because it sounds like we really need to get someone from the company on the show, maybe Davida, who hasn't been on the show yet, would be a good choice to talk about this at more length. I want to get to that C that's been lingering. Everybody knows I want to mention Chapek. We've actually seen what Chapek has released. It's on the website live now. You can go check it out yourself. It is a full gold Chapek Antarctique called the Mount Erebus. And it has, for the first time since the very first Terre Adélie models released in the Antarctique line in May 2020, the Lame dial finish. Now, Chapek promised when they released the Terre Adélie that the Lame dial would not return in that same model group. So they obviously couldn't bring it back in a stainless steel case. They obviously replaced it with the Stairway to Eternity Flinquet dial that we saw in the Passage de Drake. Now, however, in a full gold case, which is, I think, a timely release for Chapek, it makes its long-awaited return. I think it's gorgeous. It has a 55,000 euro or 53,700 CHF price tag. It's expensive, but obviously after the Revelation was released last year and stepped the price for a non-precious metal Antarctique up to the mid-30s, it doesn't seem like a crazy, crazy, crazy jump. Quick takeaways on the Mount Erebus, please, and then David will move on to your next brand of choice.
I want to use one word when I saw that picture, and the famous Jean-Claude Biver uses it a lot. It's his signature. And he says, God damn! Wow, what a stunning beauty. I mean, we could have all expected that watch to come. We could have all guessed how it would look. But nothing beats a finished product, a real product. And I can't wait to hold it, not in my hands, but put it on my wrist. Wow, mamma mia. I'm in love. I'm sorry. I don't want to love it, but it tickles my fancy. It even gets on the nomination list because, as you all know, my brother and I are still shopping for a gold watch, meaning gold case, gold bracelet. This suddenly became a nominee. Congrats, Chapek.
I guess we need to do a limited real-time show edition of it that would make it the perfect watch for you and Amir to wear, right?
Well, we know who can pull a Chapek collab off because the most wanted collab still today is a green dialed version. And I know someone who was responsible for that.
I don't know what you're talking about. David, what do you think about the Mount Erebus?
I suppose in line with my philosophy of trying to pare down, I try and tone down my desire for watches that I will probably never own. You know, to me, a gold version of a watch has always just looked like a gold version of a watch. But I do agree that in this particular case, and I'm not saying this to agree with you both, it does seem to work better in full gold. It really does. And as you were both talking, I was thinking that if I were of the mind and of the budget to want a Vacheron Constantin 222, but could not get one, I think this would be a completely worthy alternative. I really think it works. It has the same vibes. And it does. It looks better than what the steel version was.
Yeah, it really is the majestic realization of a perfect concept, I think. And I love the 222 as well. And I didn't think I would say this, but I think this is better. Could it be even better if it were a little smaller, like in the smaller case size? Maybe. I don't know. I've had both the Chapek Antarctique case sizes on my wrist, and the bigger one is kind of better. It breathes a little more. It has a little bit more space to it. Chapek says that if your wrist is over 16.5 centimeters in diameter, that the larger size is wearable. That's exactly what my wrist sizes, and I've always found it to be an incredibly comfortable watch because although it is 40.5 millimeters in diameter, it's only 10.9 millimeters thick. So it really isn't a hefty piece of metal to wear on your wrist, and I can't wait to try this one on. I have seen a yellow gold prototype in the past, and I have to say it was divine. This one, though, with the lame dial, oh, yeah, pure nectar. David, next brand, please.
Hublot, baby. Let's talk Hublot, because Hublot is a brand that I don't think gets a lot of love from the community either. It's changing, but the three of us have spent a lot of time talking about the technical contributions that they have made to the industry. And they have a design language that is, it's Hublot. When you see one, you're like, I know exactly where that's from. And credit to them for really understanding what their value proposition is. So, you know, as far as what I want to see, I would love a Unico chronograph. That's still on my list of things to buy. So I would love to see one of the 42 millimeter versions in just some wild shade of I'm going to say hot pink. I want to see a hot pink Hublot this year from Watches and Wonders.
You know, I'm a big fan of the Texilum material that was sparingly deployed on a sort of green camo version, a blue Lapo Elkan edition. I think there was a gray one as well. It had King Gold pushes on that green one, which I really loved. But my real soft spot from Hublot is the Magic Gold, which is the gold that is forced into a vacuum-formed carbon billet and then cut with an electrified diamond wire so that it can be shaped into a watch case and then thereafter is completely indestructible. I would like to see, so I'll go with pink, David, that's a nice one. I'd like to see a pink Texilum Big Bang chronograph with magic gold elements integrated to the case. Yes, please.
Yeah, if you're going to do something, do it all the way. And if, Rob, if you're going to let me, can I jump a little bit backwards in the alphabet now? Because this might be one that all three of us want to talk about some more. That's H. Moser. So quick fact about H. Moser. I've just started getting an F1, and I live about 25 minutes from the Alpine facility. So I have decided that that is my team now. It's the hometown team. Both the drivers are French. And it turns out that H. Moser is their watch sponsor, basically. So maybe I'll have an H. Moser in the future just based on that. But I think being a little more general here, what I love about H. Moser is some of the novelties that they bring. And when I say novelties, I mean actual novelties. They have a really good sense of humor and it's executed well. So I would love to see some equivalent of the cheese watch, you know, that one kind of Frankenstein watch where it was like a mix of everything, all of the hot watches, or their take on the Apple Watch, I think was phenomenal. So I would love to see. Obviously, you know, their usual catalog is great, but I want to see what joke they decide to tell on everyone in good fun, obviously, for the year 2024. What do you both think?
I think they're going to surprise us with an evolution. I don't expect a revolution. I've seen some novelties, but again, I'm scared, embargo or not. I want to maybe do an intermezzo, take a top level helicopter view, and just do a quick round of mind reading of the three of us, what we think trends will be for the industry. I don't think it will be a revolution year, meaning evolution, meaning a lot of line extension, meaning dial variation, material variations, but not shocking innovation. I think that 2023 was a year that started cooling down the watch industry. That always causes for evolutions and not revolutions the year or years after. We started off this episode by talking and predicting or assuming what brands should do when markets shift. So I don't really expect crazy stuff. I guess we'll see the trend of more green dials again, probably. I don't know why, but I think we'll see a lot of burgundy reddish dials. It's interesting that Chapek went the gold route, but that links back to Rob's story. They probably had it in the pipeline years ago. Difficult to pivot away from it, so you need to launch. I mean, if they had the ability to produce a gold watch within 3 months, I guess they would have decided after summer 23 not to do it.
I don't think that's the case, actually, when it comes to the CHEPIC. I think that the higher price of gold is not something brands are too afraid of. I don't think that the tens and tens and tens of thousands euro watches are really that much, are really threatened at all. I think that they are the safest part of the industry in many ways. I think it's the core stuff, the entry-level stuff that each brand offers that needs the most revision. And if we want to see a trend, I'm not even going to talk about colors. I think that we'll probably see, yeah, a continued reduction in sizes in general, but also a muting of extravagance. I think the brands will try and subtly reposition their core collection to a more timeless aesthetic. I think they'll do a soft reset where they can. I think they'll all realize that, okay, we need to lay some new foundations upon which we can build in the upcoming years. We can go in a different direction. We can control pricing a little better. We can make platforms a little bit more flexible so that we can react and we can change things and drop things in and drop things out as is necessary. So I would say that if we're going to see a trend of any kind, it'll be a subtle reduction of noise in collections. That's it.
I mean, I think smaller watches, well, I don't think we can call that a trend anymore. That's been sort of in the works for a while. I just don't, you know, Alan, I have to go with what you said, probably evolution rather than revolution. Again, keeping in mind that there's a lot of inertia. I don't think we'll see the big changes until next year. But also, and this is probably a topic for another discussion, but it just seems to me like unless you're an independent and you have, quote, permission to go nuts, what the market has shown is that if you try and go too crazy, you just get punished. It doesn't sell. I mean, Tudor P01, code 1159, all of that. And so I don't know that there's any reason, especially if you expect a downturn to come, to do anything but play to your hits.
I mean, I think you've hit the nail on the head there with Tudor as an example. Look at what Tudor's been doing with the Black Bay over the last few years. It has been subtilizing it. They've been shrinking it time and time again. They're making it into a different base model than where it began. And I think that that's a smart move. I think a lot of brands should take a leaf out of Tudor's book. And to use the examples of the Wilder models they released, which were maybe critically well received, but certainly not commercially as successful as, well, maybe not that they thought they would be, but maybe than they hoped. That's a perfect case study, I would say. All right, let's continue with the list. We are rapidly making our way through it, picking out our highlights. I'm going to touch on a brand that I'm not sure I'll actually have time to visit while I'm there, unfortunately, but Panerai. Because I feel Panerai's been in the wilderness a little bit like Bremont, maybe, looking for that next level to take the brand to. They've had special edition versions. They've had precious metal versions, which never really seem to sit that well with the Panerai case shape, although they are beautiful on the wrist, I must say. What do you think Panerai could do to stoke some of the enthusiasm we saw maybe 10, 15 years ago for the brand?
Well, I just got into watches actually about 15 years ago, so I think I'm lacking the context as to what made them popular in the early 2000s, which really was the rise of the Paneristi, as I understand it. What I understand drove them at the time was a hunger for large watches, which is just not there anymore. And also large watches worn by Sylvester Stallone and Arnold Schwarzenegger, who don't have the same cultural capital that they used to have. So I think you can take that off the table. As far as what they can do, I think they've done a good job of trying to focus on experiences. So they've got some really interesting packages where you buy a watch and you go on an experience with a famous explorer, which I think is great. But I think they could do a lot more around not smaller, but more compact. And they tried that with the Douay, which looks awesome, but it had 30 meters of water resistance and a snap-on case back, which I don't know who approved that. It was a terrible choice, and I think that that needs to be revisited and done properly. And if they can do that, I think that'll be a huge first step into getting the brand back on people's radars. What do you both think?
Well, I definitely agree with the Douay or Duo or whatever they called it being a travesty. It shouldn't have existed. It wasn't what people buy Panerai for. It was the right idea, but really, really poorly executed, in my opinion. The one Panerai I've owned in my life, I sold it and I would like to buy it back at some point, was the Radio Mir 1940 Special Edition, which I think had the best of every world. Had the old Rolex-style crown, had the Radio Mir date layout, had a 42mm case diameter, and it had the solid lugs that are more commonly associated with Luminor, but it didn't have the big bridging crown protector, as it were. That was heaven. Also had the display case back, it had sufficient water resistance. It was a Panerai, but it was wearable. It had all of the calling cards, the classic designs, and kind of cherry-picked the best bits from several eras. Why not make a line like that as the standard model? Because there isn't so much to replace for 44, 45, 46, 47, and plus diameter models these days. That one was heaven.
Just on topic of Panerai, I would love them to break the shackles of being a retro historic inspired brand and say, you know what? We live in the 2020s. Let's make a contemporary Panerai watch. So meaning true instrument for professional soldiers, army personnel, and see what they can come up with. Because I've said this several times on air, many brands are willingly or unwillingly prisoners of their own past or heritage, or I call it trapped in the retro trend, the vintage inspired trend. So that's my two cents on Panerai. I wanted to, maybe because we're slowly going to the end of the show, maybe all of us pick a few zigzag brands and just quickly say, fire some shots, what they hope to see. But before we do so, David,
I know that it's very easy for us to armchair quarterback, you know, being a CEO here, but I'm just looking at the families for Panerai watches. It's the Luminor, the Submersible, and the Radio Mir. And every single one of those is iconic. Like, you can look at it and say, that's a Panerai. And so for them to be so lost, quote unquote, it's just, it's bizarre. And for them to be a group brand as well, which, you know, when you're a group brand, the goal is to make as much money as possible. And it's just weird. Like, it doesn't seem like there's a lot that needs to be done, because companies would love to have one icon. Panerai has three. So it doesn't seem like it should be that hard to get them back on the right footing.
I just feel like those three icons are all basically the same watch, though. Like, I know that there's significant differences that mark them apart from one another, but like I just said, the Radio Mir is kind of a mishmash of at least the Radio Mir and the Luminor. And it's better than both, in my opinion. It takes the best elements of both and has a little bit of that throwback element with the crown. I think the problem Panerai has, and this feeds into something I was talking about recently in an article, when I buy watches from brands, I try to find the model that best expresses what that brand is good at to keep in my collection. Funnily enough, it's not always the watch that I like the most. It's the one that I find most satisfying as an execution and expression of that brand's goals. So on occasion, I've bought multiple watches from the same brand and worn them all for a long time to figure out which one I think really hits that sweet spot. And it has everything that brand offers in the neatest package. So for example, take Laventure. I have the Marine, the Submarine in bronze, and the Automobile Chronograph. Three Laventures, very similar case designs, slight upgrades on each subsequent model from the Marine through to the Automobile. I've recently decided that the only one I actually need in my life is the Submarine, the middle one, the second model that he made. I've got the first and the fifth models either side of it. I love the original Marine. I never thought I'd sell it. Now I know I could live without it. I love the Automobile as a design. I think it's really, really cool, but it never really bonded with me because it never really expressed what I thought the brand should have been about. The Submarine, however, for all its flaws, and it does have some flaws, like a dead date position that winds me up, and a steel buckle that can now be replaced with a bronze buckle because Clermont has kindly decided to provide those for us at last, that one's perfect. When it comes to Panerai, I think the issue is about taking a brand forward into the 2020s, Alon, as you say, is that's not what I go to Panerai for. I go to Panerai for a Radio Mir or a Luminor, or better still, the Radio Mir 1940. That's what I go there for. That's what I expect. If Panerai came out with a watch that wasn't cushion-shaped and wasn't made of steel, or wasn't made of steel, let's say, because they have done cushion shapes that are not made of steel, and they're abysmal in my mind as well, I wouldn't want it. I wouldn't want to buy a non-cushion-shaped watch from Panerai because I've got a million other brands to choose from that have made non-cushion-shaped watches their thing. That's how I feel about it.
David, here, a new article for you. And that's the reason why I don't go to Panerai, because the first year they came out, I fell head over heels in love. And now, what is it? 3 decades later, calling it the Vendôme Richemont chapter. I'm bored. I want something new. But let's pour that into an article. I'm going to take the baton and quickly zigzag through the brands that I quickly want to highlight that I have expectations for, or I'm curious to see what they're doing. I'm very curious to see if Benoît de Clercq, the new CEO of Zenit, had time to inject some of his DNA into the Zenit DNA. That being said, our dear friend Julien Tournard, I'm curious to see if he has time to put his stamp on Tag Heuer. We've seen at Prilob launch already. That beautiful watch. People know I love that brand with a moon face. Seen the picture. Very curious. Rob and I, we are going to Tudor. A lot of speculations going around for Rolexes with these Photoshop prediction things that I personally don't like because it confuses consumers that are not balls deep like us into the watch loving hobby. And they think that that actually launches by brands. So people are anticipating a smaller Black Bay GMT. Maybe we'll see it. I'm not even going to predict Rolexes or Pateks. I am very curious to hold the new Chronos Swiss with their proprietary movement because I'm purposely ignored David's comment about Bremont being manufactured or not because that's a chapter on its own. And finally, scrolling through the Pal Expo list of brands, I am very curious to see what Nomos will bring more because one thing is on the embargo. I am super excited about it. I'm not going to say more because I'm not objective. I'm a Nomos retailer and you that all listen to it know that that's the linking brand between Rob and me. Who wants to go next?
I don't think I've provoked enough, so I will start by saying the ones I don't care about. Patek Philippe and Rolex, I just have almost no interest in. And that is not an indictment of the quality of the watchmaking. It's going to be fantastic, but I think what's happened with those two brands over the last couple of years, it's going to take a lot of time to get the aftertaste out of my mouth for what's gone on there, I think. And that's maybe not their fault entirely. But yeah, I just don't really care, honestly. The ones that I do care about really quickly is Gerard Lacoultre. That's another brand that I think could be doing a lot more than it already does in terms of market presence, but always interesting and always beautiful watches. Pecunier, French. So, you know, I'm obviously going to be biased when I talk about them. And I'll second Alain with Zenith. I think they've just done some really cool stuff recently. Another just very heavy hitting watchmaker, let alone brand. And so very interested to see what they release.
So I am really excited to visit Pamjani because I love Pamjani. And I think that the 36mm Tonda PF is one of the greatest modern sports watches available. I adore it. I am also keen to see Piaget and see the recent Polo in real life because I haven't had a chance to wear it yet. In terms of other brands, I'm always excited to see Ulysse Nadan because I love the team behind Ulysse Nadan, especially, and they do great work that doesn't often get the respect I feel it deserves. And although we haven't time to touch on the brands exhibiting away from Palexpo today, I'll just throw out a few names of the ones I'm most excited to be visiting. Obviously, we have our good friends at Elka to visit. You know, we're obviously going to see SYE. We're going to see the guys from Fears, all these people that we love hanging out with. We're going to have dinner with Sylvain Bernaron, of course, because how can you not have dinner with Sylvain Bernaron when the opportunity is on the table? And then I love Moran Musi. Always have done, always will. I cannot wait to see HYT, our dear friend Vahe. That'll be incredible. That's very exciting. The new Space One, which has been tirelessly communicated to me by friend of the show, Mary Ansell of 289 Consulting, is going to be wonderful. We're hooking up with our friends from Bulgari. We're seeing Catherine Fabrizio and Antoine, which is going to be great. Obviously, MB&F is always exciting. And last but not least, I can't wait to see Alain Ben Joseph. That's it, the greatest brand of all time.
Oh my God. I love you, bro. No, but really, really, that is the highlight for me, just to hang with you. Unfortunately, only 2 days. I always see the cup half full. Fortunately, 3 days, we're going to have a blast. because that is the highlight. Hanging with your bro, seeing old friends, making new friends, holding off all the groupies that want a piece of the nuds show.
Okay, stop that now.
So now that's going to be, but you took it off the Palex. Well, so David, you go first and then I'll do some more highlights. Sorry, this is going to be a longer than an hour show.
Yeah, and I don't want to maybe belabor this because we could talk for hours. I did want to get your thoughts, and this was partly by design because we started at I don't really care about what Patek and Rolex release. What are your thoughts on those two brands? Rolex in particular, because that's the one everyone wants to talk about. So without maybe going into predictions, what's your general sense? Do you agree with me or am I way off base?
I mean, I don't know how to say it other than making subtle predictions, but I think it's about time we got some more bezel colors in the GMT Master 2 line. I would love a Coke. I've seen recently, I think it was on Watch Pro, a mock-up. Alan hates these, I know, but a red bezel, an all-red bezel GMT Master 2 looked really cool. Didn't expect it, didn't want it, didn't know I wanted it, although it does look pretty nice. I keep trying on GMT Master 2s when I go to Rolex boutiques, and I'm amazed at how well they wear. I'm always surprised at how small they are in real life, and that's a nice thing to be surprised about. I reckon that there'll just be a lot of, as Alan always says, evolutions, not revolutions. Patek, I have no idea. And again, it's not really on my radar. Top quality, but just not for me. Alan?
I don't hate them. The thing is, you have a responsibility when you do that to put maybe a big rubber stamp-esque thing over it. Concept, dummy, not real, not in production. And I'm saying this more as a measure of protecting not only your brand as a media outlet, but also protecting the brand that you're actually, well, copyright infringing. But is it copyright infringement? Another article I test here. But it confuses the masses. And we know that, 80, 90% of Rolex buyers are not watch nerds or watch fans per se. So it's more from that point of view that I say that. I love the fact that you have no freaking idea what Patek is going to do. And that's the joy. And that's one of the reasons whenever I visit the fair, the first thing I do is just walk around, catch the vibe, look in the windows, be amazed and amused as a consumer. First stand is always Patek for me. And with Rolex, no idea. People expect new Milgau, which is logical. I kind of hope they bring the Explorer 1 back as 39 because I think the 40 is too big. But after last year with so much firework, I think it will be a relaxed year for Rolex. So I'm leaving virtually Pal Expo on this beautiful journey we're doing together. I am actually very curious to sit down with you together, Rob, at Tutima. We're going to see them. I had a taster at Inhorgenta, the Munich fair. You already mentioned the HYT, which I'm very excited for, to see what our dear friend Vahe's stamp on that brand is going to be. He now had 6 months to put his vision on the brand. We're going to Bulgari. Actually, we have a triple appointment there, so that's going to be fun. I am looking forward for Reservoir. Super fun what they do. I call them the king of retrograde. And finally, I am indeed very curious to see the Space One that I'm also getting bombarded with, but not by our dear sweetheart Marie, but simply by sexy boy Guillaume on Instagram. And, well, time to watch is going to be fun because there are loads of friends there. We have to mention Elka. We have to mention Fears. We have to mention, who did I forget? David, mic is yours.
You guys are warming my heart with the French brands. Reservoir is actually a French brand, if I remember correctly. So don't own one of their watches, but maybe will. I think they're growing on me. I think they made a dive watch a little while ago, which just really struck me. And please, both of you, correct me if I'm wrong, but it really struck me as having their design language and being there. So excited to see them. And yeah, I think the Space One, can't see myself buying it. I just don't know if we get a lot of wrist time, but I have an idea of what it's going to be. I think I've seen one teaser shot. And credit to Guillaume and Theo for doing that. I think it's a testament to, you know, the watch supply chains and what's possible when two ingenious people get together and leverage some of those globalized supply chains now. So super excited to see that.
Yeah, the more we talk about that new Space One, the more excited I am for it, because I really, really think this might be one for me. I know I passed on the previous one, but I do sometimes regret it. I don't know if I'm going to make the same mistake again. We'll find that soon enough, because in less than 2 weeks, we will have boots on the ground in Geneva, and we will be racing around these almost 100 meetings, either together or separately, and bringing you as much content as we can from the fair itself. If you would like us to ask any questions to the brands while we're present in Geneva, then please do get in touch via the usual channels. You can contact us either via our Instagram handle, @therealtime.show. You can contact any of us via email. Now, David has his own email address as well. It's either Rob, Alon, or David @therealtime.show. Or you can contact us via the contact form on the website, www.therealtime.show. Keep your eyes peeled to the website for developments coming very, very soon. It's an exciting time for the show, and we're glad to have you all coming along on this ride with us. Until next time, stay safe and keep on ticking.